She probably has the best healthcare system of anyone in the United States right now. She gets a visit from her doctor weekly.
Seward Sea Life Center anticipates a new edition this spring. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 16th of February. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, Ketchikan tries to prevent potential job losses with the Coast Guard.
This is a blip in their budget. It really is. But to us, in this community, it means a lot.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Joshua Allen Wade has admitted to killing two women, according to court papers filed today. The documents are terms of a plea agreement between federal prosecutors and the 29-year-old. He's accused of the 2007 torture and murder of his neighbor, Mindy Schloss. But in the filing, Wade also admits killing another Anchorage woman, Della Brown, in 2000. A jury acquitted Wade of that crime. Prosecutors were seeking the death penalty in the Schloss case, but the plea agreement only calls for a 99-year sentence without parole for Wade. He is expected to change his plea in U.S. District Court in Anchorage tomorrow and be sentenced. The Seward Sea Life Center is celebrating big news. One of the center's stellar sea lions is pregnant. It's the first time in four decades a stellar has been expecting a pup in captivity in the United States, and researchers hope monitoring the experience will offer clues into why the population is struggling so much in the wild. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The Sea Life Center has two female stellar sea lions, Sugar and Kiska, and a male named Woody. Throughout last summer's breeding season, the three spent as much time as possible together. Researcher Lori Palaszczuk says sparks seem to fly, especially between Woody and Kiska.
She runs up and interacts with him and then runs away, which provides a little more entertainment for Woody. He definitely wants to chase her. He wants to herd her around the habitat. Sugar comes up quite willingly to him, and he doesn't seem as interested.
So he was, like, responsive to hard to get.
Right. We need to tell Sugar to play the game a little bit more.
The sea lion interactions were intensely monitored by a team of staff. They captured breeding behavior like biting, sniffing, and marking territory. But they didn't catch the one thing that would have sealed the deal.
We saw zero copulations. We started video monitoring them, but we didn't ever see them physically interact in a mating event.
Still, the females had regular ultrasounds to see if they were pregnant. For months, nothing showed up. The staff had pretty much given up on a sea lion pregnancy this time around. Then, in mid-December, veterinarian Carrie Gertz was doing a routine ultrasound on Kiska.
I wasn't really paying too much attention to looking for something like a fetus, but then a few white spots floated by as I was scanning, and I go, oh, wait a second.
Those spots were the spine of a sea lion fetus. Lori Palaszczuk said she had to see it herself to believe it. The next day, she joined Gertz for a follow-up ultrasound.
And sure enough, Kiska had a beautiful pup. You could see the entire spine, a great heartbeat that was going. And we even saw the little hind flippers rub together. It really was, it's like seeing a friend's child. It was a really uplifting moment that this had been successful.
Kiska is 16 years old, not a young mom, about 40 in human years. If all goes well, she'll give birth toward the end of May. In the meantime, her life at the Sea Life Center goes on pretty much as normal.
Good bark. Good girl.
Mammalogist Amber Stevens has noticed Kiska seems less hungry on occasion and more sluggish as she puts on her pregnancy weight.
We do see her energy just a little bit different. She seems to just kind of haul out and
stay dry and just kind of relax more often than we normally see her. But that's very common as they start to gain weight. They just want to be more lazy. Where you going?
Kiska's also getting a lot more attention from her vets.
She probably has the best healthcare system of anyone in the United States right now. She gets a visit from her doctor weekly. She gets regular ultrasounds. She continues to get normal fish and vitamins that she would normally get.
The wild Stellar sea lion population has declined steadily since the 1970s. The species is especially struggling in western Alaska, where numbers have fallen by as much as 80%. Biologists aren't allowed to research adult females in their natural environment because of the stress it could put on the animals. Palaszczuk says that means this study can look at some important questions that can't be answered anywhere else.
We are specifically looking at what is the energetic cost of pregnancy, and what is the energetic cost of maintaining a pup?
The biologists are also interested in how Kiska will respond to next summer's breeding season, and if she becomes pregnant again, how her body will take the added stress of a new pregnancy while she's feeding her pup.
It's a huge investment, but to be lactating and then pregnant with another animal, I can't even fathom the cost or the toll that it's going to take on a body, and then to continue to maintain your own body condition to weather food shortages, weather problems, fish species moving, disturbances by tourist vessels. On top of all this, this can be a very costly time for a mom.
Biologists hope to continue the study for 5 years, and next season, they'd like to celebrate pregnancies for both Kiska and Sugar. In Seward, I'm Annie Feit.
A public hearing on Friday evening over the critical habitat proposal for Cook Inlet's beluga whales drew well over 100 Anchorage residents. And while everyone agreed that the belugas need to be safe, the division over just what that means remains strong. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
In three-minute allotments, a steady stream of speakers came forward. Anchorage Water and Wastewater Utility Assistant General Manager Brett Jokala followed a theme often heard from the city since the possible proposal first appeared. The whales needed protection, but...
We are concerned, however, that the designation and the primary constituent elements of critical habitat, as currently described, will be prone to misuse and may serve as cannon fodder for needless litigation. We therefore strongly encourage you to provide a better description of the function of the designation.
Anchorage City Manager George Vakalis described unknown impacts for the proposed Kinnick Arm Crossing Bridge, or the day-to-day activities at the Port of Anchorage.
It's very hard for people to understand what this all means. It's one thing to put a designation in, but if you don't specify what it really means and what's going to be the cause and effect, then folks have an awful hard time of understanding that.
In 2008, the National Marine Fisheries Service of the National Oceanic Administration listed the Cook Inlet beluga as a specific endangered species. By federal regulation, the Fisheries Service then had to consider the status of its habitat. On December 1st, the service proposed as critical habitat the Upper Cook Inlet, south of Calgon Island and extending north to the Turnagain and Kinnick Arms. Also included is Kachemak Bay, as well as a three-mile strip along Cook Inlet's western shore. Carla Dutton, the Alaska director of the Defenders of Wildlife, disagreed that the designation impacted responsible projects and activities.
Your own analysis shows the cost of critical habitat are relatively low compared to the benefits of a viable, healthy beluga whale population, the fisheries and the habitat that they depend on and that Alaskans enjoy.
Mandy Maguire, a marine mammal specialist in the service's Protected Resource Division, gave a summary of the proposal. She said the habitat designation focuses only on projects working through federal agencies, and very few projects requiring consultations are ever restricted.
17,052, that's how many consultations we have conducted nationwide, and of those, only 42 have resulted in a determination that the project would adversely modify the critical habitat.
Maguire noted several people spoke about the designation's financial impact. She says without specific details, it's impossible to make an overall cost estimate.
without knowing how the project is going to be designed, when the project's going to be active, what the operational periods are, what the construction timings are going to be, we can't place a dollar figure on those activities to know if a critical habitat designation might cause the project to change because of the critical habitat.
The Anchorage gathering was the last of four Alaska public hearings. The public may still make written comments through March 3rd. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Alaska snowboarder Kalyn Chythluk-Sifsoff didn't make it past the Olympic qualifying round in today's snowboard cross event. The Girdwood athlete apparently fell in both qualifiers. She completed the first run far behind the field and didn't finish her second run. Dense fog made for difficult conditions. Border cross was Chythluk-Sifsoff's only Olympic event. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an invention that could transform the Bristol Bay salmon fishery.
You know, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to see that when a fish lands on a trampoline, it's so much better than hitting a hard deck.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
The state last year received $6.8 million from gamblers on cruise ships running casinos in Alaska waters. Anchorage Democrat Harry Crawford doesn't want that money. He says it comes with a downside.
What I don't want to do is open the door to for-profit gambling into the state. What we're afraid of is that this initiative that started taxing the cruise ship industry on their gambling within state waters opens the door.
The initiative he's referring to was approved by the public in 2006 as part of the ballot measure that imposed a head tax on cruise ship passengers. The cruise ships are not allowed to break out the dice when they are in port, but gambling is not specifically forbidden in state waters. And although not permitted, the cruise ships must give the state a third of their take. The Parnell administration doesn't agree with Crawford's concerns. Joanna Bales, deputy director of the tax division, says the revenue and law department officials do not believe that taxing is synonymous with legalization.
The only reason that these cruise ships are allowed to conduct gaming activities is because federal law prohibits the state of Alaska from making that illegal in Alaska waters. So basically, gambling in Alaska is illegal. Gambling in Alaska state waters is also illegal except for this one prohibition under federal law.
The sponsors of the cruise ship initiative don't see any immediate need to repeal the tax. Joe Geldof helped write the law. He says the sponsors decided to tax it at a high enough rate to keep it from being a profitable onboard activity.
I don't think it raises significant questions about Indian gaming. And the point where you need to take that up is if somebody comes and says, I want the cruise ship deal and I want to sign a compact, that's where you should take this up probably and decide whether you want to pull the plug on the ostensible state sanction.
The bill was held for further hearings as Crawford promised to provide documentation to members on the Indian Gaming Act and gambling compacts in other states. Alaska Senator Mark Begich and Ketchikan Gateway Borough officials hope to keep the Coast Guard cutter Acushnet in service or expedite the production of two fast response vessels that would replace it. The Ketchikan-based cutter is slated to be decommissioned next year. Begich met with the Coast Guard's second-in-command last week. KRBD's Maria Duzak has this report.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich met with Coast Guard Vice Admiral Robert Papp on Thursday to discuss the future of the Coast Guard cutter Acushnet. The 66-year-old Acushnet is one of five Coast Guard cutters slated for decommissioning in the President's 2011 budget. Two smaller patrol vessels are scheduled to replace the Acushnet and be stationed in Ketchikan in 2014. Begich says though Pat made no commitments during the meeting, the discussion was productive.
We recognize the concern that the Coast Guard has on this vessel. It's a World War II era vessel, so it's clearly outdated and has high maintenance costs and needs to be replaced. But our concern is that gap of time. One is the jobs for Ketchikan, and then the other piece is the life safety component that vessel offers us. So he was sympathetic, no commitment, but enough discussion to understand Alaska's needs.
PAP is President Obama's nominee for Commandant, the Coast Guard's highest-ranking member. If confirmed by the U.S. Senate, Begich says PAP would replace Admiral Thad Allen this spring. Begich says PAP served in Alaska, and his familiarity with the state is beneficial to discussions.
He has been to Alaska, has been stationed in Alaska. He understands Alaska. He wanted to make that point very clear to us. So that was a huge kind of plus up, you might say.
Begich says the Acushnet directly provides about 85 jobs to Ketchikan and is also important for life safety reasons. If decommissioned next year, he says there would be a 3-year gap before the Acushnet is replaced by the fast response vessels. Ketchikan Gateway Borough Mayor Dave Kiefer echoed the senator's concerns. Kiefer says if the Acushnet is decommissioned next year, the impact to the local economy would be far-reaching.
We've estimated that between the crew and shore staff and families, you're looking at anywhere from 130 to 140 people. That's more than 1% of the borough's population.
Kiefer says he and several other borough representatives met with Coast Guard officials in Washington, D.C. last year. At the time, he says they were told the Acushnet would not be decommissioned until the replacement vessels were in place.
I fear that if they remove the Acushnet and 2 or 3 or 4 years pass before a replacement vessel comes to Ketchikan, they will decide they don't need to replace the vessel at all. And that's a significant blow to our community.
Kiefer says he understands budget pressures, but says the cost to keep the Acushnet in Ketchikan is insignificant in the Coast Guard's overall budget.
This is a blip in their budget. It really is. But to us, in this community, it means a lot.
Begich says he expects to receive the construction schedule for the fast response vessels soon. He says he will determine the next course of action after receiving that information. Multiple attempts to contact Coast Guard officials in Washington, D.C. for this story were unsuccessful. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
The new director of NOAA Fisheries introduced himself to the press this morning with a nationwide conference call. Eric Schwab was named the assistant administrator for the National Marine Fisheries Service by NOAA Administrator Jane Lubchenco late last week. Most recently, Schwab has been the deputy secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, an agency he's been with since 1983 when he started as a wildlife enforcement officer. He has also served on the Mid-Atlantic Fishery Management Council, which is comparable to the North Pacific Council, which manages federal fisheries off Alaska.
Obviously, my top priority going forward is to promote management that builds sustainable fisheries and vibrant coastal communities. To accomplish that, I see as a major priority improving outreach and relationships with commercial and recreational fishermen all around the country.
Schwab touted catch shares as an important means for achieving management goals, but added that they are not a one-size-fits-all solution.
I'm not in a position right now to really to speak to the details of any particular fishery, but I would absolutely say, I think there are important tools out there that we can take better advantage of, but we have to do that in close consultation with local communities to minimize, some of the impacts of some of these management challenges.
Opponents say catch shares can result in the consolidation of fisheries and job loss for fishing communities. Schwab added that as long as processor quota shares remain a legal tool for regional fisheries councils to use, they will be considered when appropriate. In certain fisheries, a processor share guarantees processing companies a portion of the catch, forcing fishermen to deliver to them instead of to the processor that pays the most. There will be a rally of commercial and recreational fishermen on the steps of the United States Capitol next week, including some Alaskans. Schwab says he will likely attend.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ACS. With Android on ACS, an app is available to listen to NPR programming on your phone. Complete details at acsalaska.com. And by Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com.
Today is the last day for public comments on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's plan to control the number of Yukon River Chinook salmon caught incidentally by the Pollock trawl fleet in the Bering Sea. With even subsistence kingfishing on the river shut down this summer to meet the requirements of a treaty with Canada and a federal fisheries disaster declaration, villagers have been campaigning for stronger measures to curtail the bycatch. On today's public radio call-in show, Talk of Alaska, Representative Don Young said it might be time to consider enhancing the Yukon River's salmon runs with hatcheries.
I'd like to see the state put a fish hatchery in the Porcupine River. They do have a small run now. It goes up to Old Crow. There's no pressure on that run. And we could generate a tremendous amount of new fish and quit arguing over the fish we have. Let's produce more fish.
It would be located where the Porcupine River flows into the Yukon River, Fort Yukon, which is Young's Alaska home. The Yukon does already have one small hatchery in Canada, near Whitehorse. Responding to several questions about the Yukon River salmon issue, Young said he favors incentives to cut down the Pollock trawl fleet's bycatch. The plan now out for comment sets a hard cap of 60,000 Chinook if a vessel signs onto an incentive plan. Should the cap be reached, the entire fishery would be shut down. Young said his recommendation was for a lower cap and a stronger incentive.
One of the suggestions I had, and this is again up to the council, I will not tell the council what to do. But I've suggested to them that they lower that cap, that quota of bycatch. It was too high. They lower it to a lower point. And then they award those that don't catch bycatch by able to catch more of the Pollock's quota.
The Pollock fleet caught 120,000 Chinook in 2007, twice as many fish as the hard cap would have allowed. But in 2008, the bycatch dropped to about 20,000, and last year it was below that. Young said managers need better information about the Yukon River's salmon runs. A longtime Bristol Bay drift fisherman has invented a device intended to help keep salmon from being bruised, cut, and stepped on as they are being picked out of nets. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Dave Hansen is from Bellingham, Washington, and he skippers the fishing vessel Eskimo Viking. His quest for a better quality fish led him to create a device that has come to be known as the salmon slide. It's basically a device that prevents fish from hitting the deck after they've been picked out of the net. Hansen says it can help prevent fish from getting bruised.
They're getting sloshed back and forth by the waves. They're getting stepped on. They're getting kicked forward into the fish hatches. And on many vessels, there's all these sharp edges, you know, hatch combings, railroad tracks for the reel. So there's just multiple sources for these fish to get bruises. And that's the huge issue in Bristol Bay, is the poor quality and primarily due to bruising.
The latest version of Hansen's idea is the third incarnation that he's tested on his vessel over the past few years, and it basically intercepts fish between the net and the deck and then slides them into a chute that then moves the fish to the holds. Hansen says he initially started with just a square piece of rubberized tarp.
It helped quality for sure. It doesn't take a brain surgeon to see that when a fish lands on a trampoline, it's so much better than hitting a hard deck. But that square tarp, it created a lot of problems. The fish got underneath it. It was underfoot, underway. The crew didn't like it.
Hansen was not happy with the first incarnation of the salmon slide and decided to try again by bringing his boat down to Washington. Hansen confirmed that he received some financial assistance from Trident Seafoods to develop a better system.
And I finally came up with what I thought would work. And so by attaching the trampoline solidly on the reel end, solidly on the roller end, you could create a real tight trampoline.
Hansen says he used the salmon slide extensively this past summer, and it had some added benefits that he didn't foresee.
Primarily, listing of the vessel, especially with refrigerated systems with using a lot of water. Water follows the list. If you start listing to the port, the water starts going to the port, and that list gets worse. this system of mine just eliminated that. The fish slid down the trampoline. We discovered right away that, hey, if we put a buoy on the port side, they can't go port anymore. They all have to go to the starboard. Worked beautifully. That was the biggest unforeseen benefit, the directional capability of using this thing, putting the fish wherever you wanted them.
Last week, Hansen demonstrated the salmon slide for processors and interested fishermen in Bellingham, Washington. And earlier this week, he did the same in Dillingham. Hansen confirmed that he has orders for 50 salmon slides, and he anticipates that there could be 100 to 150 slides in use in the bay this coming summer. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Kate Shugak is on a case and couldn't make a personal appearance, but the city of Palmer has designated today as Kate Shugak Day. The fictional heroine of Anchorage author Dana Stabenow's mystery series is becoming well-known around the country, well enough to inspire a television series. David Cheesham, who owns Fireside Books in Palmer, says both character and author are heroes.
Kate is a fictitious hero, and she represents kind of the Alaska that isn't sanitized, the hard on the outside and but big heart on the inside character that just tears through the scars and the problems and the challenges and comes out with her moral center intact and solves crimes in the meantime.
He says Dana Stabenow is a hero because she refused to grant film rights to her work unless the series would be shot in Alaska. Stabenow announced a production deal last year.
Film has a huge potential as a cultural and economic boom to Alaska and especially Palmer. I think Palmer has the potential to be the capital of film in the state, the Alaska Hollywood, you know, if you will.
Cheesham was instrumental in convincing Palmer's city council to designate the day. He calls Kate Shugak the quintessential Alaska character. The 17th novel in the series, A Night Too Dark, is being released today. The book's author is signing her novels in Arizona, but she'll be back in Alaska this weekend. Stabenow will sign books Friday evening at Barnes & Noble in Anchorage and at Fireside Books in Palmer at noon on Saturday. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, and Adam Kane and Mike Mason in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. An artist is a person who expresses themselves creatively through words, images, sounds, materials, or original performance. If you are an artist, you might be eligible for funding to support your creative work. March 1st is the deadline to apply for an individual artist awards. Learn more at rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.